remark here on a chapter chapter 7. Verse number 4. We're going back a little bit. Two observations here. First one is here in verse number 4, when God announces to Noah the actual coming down of the flood, of the starting of the flood, he already told him in the beginning of the portion that there is going to be a flood, but he didn't tell him the exact date when it's going to start. So here in verse number 4, he tells him, Ki leyamim od shiva. In another 7 days, I'm going to start the flood. Okay, so 7 days before the flood, which starts on the, by the way, it's soon the anniversary, the 17th day of Cheshvan, of the month of Cheshvan. This is when God announces to Noah the beginning of the flood. So the question here is, why does he announce the beginning of the flood 7 days before it starts? Why not a day before, or on the day when it's supposed to start, just giving him enough time to just go into the ark, and that's all? He doesn't say anywhere that it would take 7 days for Noah's last minute arrangements, right? Or why should we assume that you need 7 days? So the question then is, why does God tell him, wait 7 days and then the flood is going to start? So in the oral tradition quoted here by Rashi, says the following, that really God told him on the day when it was supposed to start, when the flood was supposed to start, I'm starting the flood, except that I'm postponing the beginning of the flood for a specific reason, for another 7 days. So for some important reason that we don't know nothing about, God decided on that day to start the flood, but he postponed it for 7 days. Says Rashi, why does God postpone the start of the flood for 7 days? Says Rashi, quoting from the Talmud, Elu Zayin Yemei Avilo Shel Methushelach. Methushelach, Methuselah, Methushelach. In last week's portion of the week, that's the grandfather of Noah. If you go back to chapter 5, the man who lived the longest anyone ever lived, in that's mentioned in the Torah. Methushelach in chapter 5, verse number 25. Is the story of Methushelah. Methushelah's son was Lemech, and Lemech's son was Noah, so that's his grandfather. And he lived for a very, very long time. In verse number 27, 969 years, right? That's what it says, the longest. Because he was a great, great tzaddik, he was a very, very righteous man. So this is why, and the days of mourning is how long? Shiva, 7 days. So he says, let's wait. Elu zayin me'aveilo, the mourning days for Methushelah, the righteous man. Shechas hakadosh baruch hu al kvodo, because God wanted to make a gesture to show a show of respect for Methushelah. Ve'ikev es hapuranut, and he held off the punishment, right? So this is the opinion which Rashi brings down. However, in the Talmud there is another opinion, and it's in this opinion it says the following. Also following the same principle, that if God tells him on this day, on the 10th day of Cheshvan, I'm supposed to start the punishment today, but I'm postponing it for a week, right? Then it means that for some reason the 10th day of Cheshvan is the proper day for the beginning of the flood. But what did God do for 7 days? For 7 days, says the Talmud, he gave the people of the generation the most enjoyment they ever had. In the words of the Talmud, he gave them pleasures, me'ein olam haba. The only way that we can describe it is pleasures out of this world. For 7 days, says the Talmud. Why?
in order for them to suffer more when the flood starts. Because the enjoyment during the last 7 days of their normal life was such that when the flood started and wiped out all those enjoyments, then the suffering was so much greater. Okay, so that was part of the judge of the punishment of the generation of the flood, that by contrast they should suffer more, because without the, those 7 days they had a great life, but not as great as it was during those 7 days. So now by contrast they suffer even more. End of statement in the Talmud. Yeah.
So why can't you just say that what God said, okay, today I'm going to do it, and then what? You got a good idea? Hey, maybe I'll wait another 7 days. Why don't you just do the last 7 days of the amount of time and let that 7 days, and then when the relative...
Exactly. So in reality, that's exactly what he did, but how did he let us know that he did it? By telling us. I was supposed to start it 7 days earlier, but I didn't. So through this, we know we have a lesson. What is the lesson? That sometimes the punishment is the contrast. That sometimes God will give pleasure to someone and take it away, and that will be a greater punishment than if he had not given to the person that pleasure. Okay? In other words, if a person is poor all his life, it's less painful than someone who is rich and he becomes poor, even though at the end they both end up in the same place. This is what the Talmud is telling us. Okay? So there is a very interesting comment made by a certain sage, an apparent contradiction to this principle. Okay? Now, again, what we derived is that it's better never to have had any money than to have had money and lost it. True? That's what it sounds like from the Talmud. So this is what is quoted to show an apparent contradiction. Do you know that after the destruction of the Temple of Jerusalem, the rabbis moved, the center of Judaism, the center of Torah moved from Jerusalem to Yavne. The city exists today, the city of Yavne. And in the city of Yavne, there was a continuation of the dynasty of Rabban Gamliel. You know, Rabban Gamliel, the family of Rabban Gamliel, was the head of the Jewish community in Israel. He was the Nasi, like the king or the president. So at a certain point in one of the Rabban Gamliel, there were three Rabban Gamliels. There was a Rabban Gamliel, then a son who was called Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, and then his son, Rabban Gamliel ben Shimon, became the president of the community, and then his son, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, became the president. So there are many Gamliels and many Shimons. So at one point, when one of the Rabban Gamliel was the president of the community, the rabbis rebelled against him. They decided to remove him from his job. He's not doing his job properly, right? And they decided we'll remove him from his job. And that was a revolution that was initiated by very, very important people. Rabbi Yoshua, Rabbi Akiva was involved, and Rabbi Eliezer. There were many great rabbis who thought that Rabban Gamliel wasn't doing a good job. Then they had to decide who to assign the job of the presidency once they removed Rabban Gamliel. And it was very, very difficult to find a proper candidate. None of those people involved in the rebellion was assigned the job, because then it would look like they had an ulterior motive when they rebelled. So they chose a person who was very, very young, 18 years old, but he was such a great sage, so righteous, that they felt he was fit for the position, and his name was Rabbi Eliezer ben Azaria. Right? So, you know, there is a story mentioned in the Haggadah that he says, I am like 70 years old. I look like 70 years old. So in the commentaries it says because he was really much younger than that. But unless he looked old, people wouldn't respect him. So it was like a miracle that he started looking older. Some people say it wasn't such a miracle. It's just when you take on such a position to be the president of the Jews, you immediately look a little older. So in any case, this is the story of Rabbi Eliezer ben Azaria. In the Talmud, it mentions the following. When the job was offered to Rabbi Eliezer ben Azaria, he went to his home and discussed it, like a good husband, with his wife. So his wife told him, "What can you are going to accept the position? You know, afterwards they'll come to terms with Rabban Gamliel and you'll be removed. So what are you gaining by being the Nasi, the head of the academy or the head of the Jewish people? So he says the following, and this is the quote in the Talmud. Better to have a crystal bowl or a cup or whatever it is for a short period of time, even though you know that it's so delicate that tomorrow it's going to break, at least you had the pleasure of using it for one day. In other words, is it better to have something so valuable for one day and then to lose it, or not to have it at all? Obviously, it's better to have it even though tomorrow it's going to break. It's as if I would tell you, I can give you very expensive plates, but you know they crack, they break. So someone might say, well, if so, don't even give it to me. Why should I have it for a day and tomorrow they are going to break? Rabbi Eliezer ben Azariah says just the opposite. If I can enjoy them for one day, it's worthwhile, so what if tomorrow it's going to break? End of statement in the Talmud, and this is why Rabbi Eliezer ben Azariah accepted his job, and his wife was right. A little time later, they came to terms with Rabban Gamliel, and then it became like a sort of a partnership between Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Eliezer ben Azariah. They ran the community together, right? So he lost his high position, but he didn't mind. Yeah.
There's a little bit of a difference. He came close to Tesla to what he said. He says that if you have something, it's better to have something, and even though you know you're not going to have it in 2 days or in a day, at least you can enjoy the pleasure now.
But wait. You're giving me the answer. Wait. Let me just point out the question. Do you hear the contradiction between the two statements in the Talmud? From here, right, from this statement that we just quoted before, it sounds like the people of the flood suffered much more because they had those pleasures during the last 7 days, because they lost it, which means that from there we can derive the fact that it's better not to have money ever than having it and losing it. Isn't that what we derive from it? This is why we consider the people of the flood having been punished much more by having been given the pleasures. But according to the principle in the Talmud, it's the exact opposite. It's much better, yes, to be rich for a short time, even though you are going to lose it, than never to have been rich at all. This is what the statement means. Better to have a very expensive plate for one day, even though tomorrow it's going to break, at least you have it for one day. So which is the right attitude? There's an apparent contradiction. Yeah, so you came up with an answer.
Yeah,
that's what?
In the statement in the Talmud, there the person realizes that, yes, I'm enjoying this and I'm getting pleasure, but he realizes that at one point he's going to lose it. So therefore, when he does lose it, it's not such a traumatic thing for him, because he anticipated the loss. So he was able to enjoy it while he had it, but yet not be so broken by the loss. However, the people by the Mabul, they thought, this is it. This is the whole life. We're never going to lose it. We have all this. That's why they didn't anticipate the loss, and so the loss was so much greater than
that. All right, so you're assuming then that Rabbi Eliezer ben Azariah was so certain that he's going to lose the job that therefore he could enjoy it as long as it lasted, even though he's going to lose it.
You don't even have to be so certain, but even if you say, I'm willing to accept it and enjoy it now, I'm an ass that if I lose it, I will lose that.
Okay. All right.
That
all right. All right. Yeah.
Isn't there another principle here that you will account have to give an accounting for the opportunity you missed? You've got to enjoy everything here for your benefit. If you don't take advantage of that benefit, then you've got to account for it. So even though you don't know what's going to happen, if an opportunity comes along, you're supposed to take advantage of it.
All right. You're right. You're right. Yeah.
It was more than they were enjoying previously.
Right.
They've always had it good. They didn't know hardship. Whereas in the case of Isaiah, he never had, and all of a sudden something comes.
Yeah.
So he says, why shouldn't I enjoy it?
All right, but
there's
still, yeah. Okay, all right, but if someone would be given such an opportunity, listen, I'm going to give you something great, but only for a week or for a year. Should I accept it? Or should I say no, because the pain of losing it, right, is greater than the pleasure of having it for a year. So how should we act? Which way should we act? From the two apparently contradictory statements in the Talmud, which advice do we get? So let me tell you, I mean, it's more, some of you had the insight into what really is the answer. The truth of the matter is that the commentaries say the following. Like you said, there are people who become slaves to physical pleasure, right? To the point that you become so hooked on it, right, that when you lose it, you go out of your mind, because this is how dependent you became on that pleasure. Those are people who have developed a certain level of materialism, physicality. In other words, the center of their lives is physical pleasure, like in a way like hedonists. The main thing in their lives is physicality. So for such a person whose center, the center of his life is the physical, it's very dangerous to become hooked on pleasure, because once it's taken away from you, the withdrawal pains are so great that it's not worth it. But what about a person who can maintain the right attitude? He knows that mainly we are spiritual people, or that's what we are supposed to be. And anything physical that we can enjoy is great, but it's secondary. Such a person will never become a slave to his pleasures. So whatever he can get, he can get. When he doesn't have it, he never became hooked on it. You hear the difference? This is why, you know what the Mesilat Yesharim, Reb Moshe Chaim Lutzato, says, why the Nazir, the person who abstains from wine, right, he's considered a holy person, he abstains from wine, even though he won't be able to make Kiddush on the Sabbath, right? So what are we saying then? Is it good to abstain from wine, or is it bad to abstain from wine? Depends who you are. If you are a person who became so dependent on wine that you can't live without it, you are the type of a person who should abstain from wine, because it's dangerous for you. The wine became your master, not your servant. Physical pleasure is your master and not your servant. So the only way that you can regain freedom from the physical world is by abstaining from the physical world. That is the rule. Whenever you feel that something physical is taking over your life, there is no other way. Abstention. There is no other way. But is there anything wrong, says the Mesilas Yesharim, with physical pleasure? Not at all. Just the opposite, as you mentioned before. Physical pleasure is something that we should accept gratefully to God for having given us the opportunity to have physical pleasure. There's nothing essentially wrong with physical pleasure.
In moderation.
What?
In moderation.
But the moderation is not an end in itself. The moderation is the method how I shouldn't become the slave to the physical pleasure. You understand what I mean? Not that, that there is an objective in moderation. What's good moderation? Why can't I enjoy the whole pleasure? Why not? I can do it if I can maintain the right relationship with the wine. The Nazir, the man who has been told to abstain from wine, is a person who became a slave to the wine. By him, the wine, which represents physical pleasures, became the center of his life. Such a person should abstain. But the person who can continue having a normal life and enjoying wine without becoming hooked on wine, that is the ideal in Judaism. Enjoy life without becoming a servant of physical pleasures. Now, this is the difference between the generation of the flood and Rabbi Eliezer ben Azariah. Rabbi Eliezer ben Azariah could enjoy his position, right, without ever affecting his freedom. He will never become a slave to his position. Let's say you were made president of a company. Of course there are certain pleasures which are related to your position, to the honor that people will show towards you. Of course, the salary that you are going to get, there are pleasures. The question is, if those pleasures become the center of your life, then the withdrawal symptoms after you lose it are so great that it's not worth it. But what about if you maintain the right attitude? It doesn't affect your essence. You are just enjoying your position, but you do not become hooked on your position. So then you can be president of the company for a year, and then you are removed, and you say, hey, I had a great time, so now I go back to my original position. So what's wrong? Nothing lost. This is the difference between Rabbi Eliezer ben Azariah and the generation of the flood. The generation of the flood was such a physical generation that when they were given pleasures, immediately they became slaves of the pleasures. As you said before, they expected it to last forever. And if not, they are go out of their minds. Rabbi Eliezer ben Azariah, even after he became president, he didn't lose his perspective towards life. He knew that's not what life is all about. So he could enjoy it without becoming hooked on it. So this is what he meant. I can enjoy it for a day, and tomorrow if it breaks, I'll say, okay, but at least I had it for a day. That is the difference, right? It's a very healthy attitude, which means you can enjoy something, but be careful. Don't make it the center of your life, okay? Now, there's one more comment here. When Noah is told to go into the ark, it says in the Talmud, Rashi quotes it, that he only went in after it started raining, right? It wasn't that the beginning of the flood started. This is in the chapter 7. Verse, I'll find it for you. Verse number 13. Yeah. No, I'm sorry. Not verse number 13. Verse number 7, I'm sorry. It says in the verse number 7 that Noah and his family went into the ark mipnei mehamabul, mipnei, because of the waters of the Mabul. What does it sound like? That only once they felt, they experienced the waters of the Mabul, of the flood, this is when they went into the ark. Says Rashi, quoting from the rabbis. Listen to this very, very difficult statement. Af Noah, even Noah, who was such a righteous man, he was miktanei amana. Literally, he was still from the small believers. You hear the statement? From the small believers. So it sounds like he didn't really believe in God. So listen to, and then he goes on to say, maimin, he did believe, ain't no maimin. He had like a dissonance, like a mixed feelings. Should I go into the ark or shouldn't I go into the ark? Will the flood come or won't the flood come? Mamin, ve'eno mamin she'yavo amabul. So when did he finally go in? Ve'lo nichnas, ad she'dochku amayim. When he had to, this is when he went in. This is a very sharp criticism. I mean, is it possible to say, I mean, this is the commentaries asked, that Noah wasn't really a great believer when for 120 years, right, he spends the last 120 years building the ark, and everybody made fun of him and threatened to kill him, and he said, listen, I'll do it because God told me to, a flood is coming, and, you know, that's it. So what does it mean that he lacked faith? That's an impossible statement on the surface. What do you mean he lacked faith? What can be greater faith than committing yourself completely to the Word of God? It just doesn't make sense. Yeah?
Like a baby and a mother. A baby can't do anything unless the mother sort of tells it to do it. If the mother tells it, then it will do it.
All right. All right. You only answered half the question. I'll tell you why. But half the question, yes. Yeah.
Possibly that, not that he didn't believe God could do it.
Yeah.
Not that he didn't believe that God had the capabilities. But maybe it's like when a teacher threatens to punish a class, right? So you know the teacher can do it, and they definitely deserve it, but you're always waiting to the last minute. Will he really do it? Will he really, really do it? You know, like,
you know, what you are saying is, even though God threatened, perhaps he'll have mercy on us,
right?
That you are saying.
Exactly.
But if so, how can the rabbis call him a small believer? The other problem. if what you are saying is right, right? So why would the rabbis call him Miktanei Amanah? Those people who have very small amount of emunah, of faith. They're the problem. Yeah.
Can we say that Noah, perhaps,
yeah,
although it's contrary to my understanding, that he had faith that tshuva could be done even up to the very last second?
Definitely. But that is not...
He
yes.
Thinking that maybe
sure.
the world would change. So
right.
until his life was in jeopardy, he then entered...
Right. Fine. Right. But let's assume that that's true, that Noah thought perhaps they'll do tshuva, and therefore, once you do tshuva, everything changes. So would you call Noah, for thinking that, a small believer? So why is it the rabbis do call him a small believer? Yes, okay. So in other words, the problem is not why Noah waited till the last minute. That's natural, as you said. It's natural because he thought there is many times that tefillah, tshuva, and tzedakah help, right? Charity, the tshuva, prayer can help. So therefore, Noah waited till the last second. So the problem is not why Noah waited for the last second. The problem is why the rabbi called him Miktanei Amanah, a small believer. Yeah? Yeah. Yeah, yeah. That's basically it. You're right. You're right, but we'll comment on it, yeah?
What if you mean by a small believer... It sounds like when you say that he was one of the small believers, that makes it seem like there was a big believer in that generation. He was the believer.
In his generation, he was the believer.
So what you could say about being a small believer, he had the small belief, the tiny small belief in his head. He still had that glimpse of hope that maybe they would do tshuva. That's what his belief was.
The statement, Miktanei Amanah, he was a small believer. I mean, he was a great believer in the power of tshuva, you know.
Well, maybe he
very, very difficult, yeah.
If he was a big believer, he would have got it as soon as the rain came. And after he waited...
No, he waited till the rain came, but he should have gone in before. Right? That's what the point. The point is, that's what it sounds like. That he should have gone in as soon as he's ready to go in. You know, why does he have to wait until the rain starts? Okay. So the point is, what you're saying, the point is like this. First of all, there are two things that we need in order to understand the answer to this question. Number one is the definition of the word emunah, to have faith. Right? There is a very widespread misconception what the word emunah really means. You know that in many prayer books you have the list of the 13 principles of faith. Ani ma'amin. I believe with full faith in the Torah, that God gave the Jews the Torah. I believe with full faith that the Nevuat Moshe Rabbeinu, that the prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu is true, right? I believe in full faith. Can a person who is pretty sure, right? Meaning, if he would have to make a decision, yes or no, he would say, yeah, there was a Mount Sinai experience. There was a Moshe Rabbeinu. But he can get himself to say that he's 100% sure. He still remains with uncertainty. Can a person with uncertainty still say, Ani ma'amin be'munah shleima, I believe with full faith? Or is it a contradiction in terms? If you believe 99%, but you have 1% of uncertainty, of doubt, then you are not a person with faith. So which way is it? Is there a contradiction between saying, I believe with full faith, and on the other hand, in the back of my mind, I say, but I'm not absolutely sure. I say most probably, but I'm not absolutely sure. Is there a contradiction? So on the surface, it sounds like yes, right? If you have any doubt at all, then you're not a person with faith. That's the way it sounds. But that's wrong. It's not that way at all. You can have all the doubts you want, all the doubts that an intelligent person has, you can have, and still have 100% faith. How is that? Yeah?
Because the faith is not having a picture of Mount Sinai in front of your face and saying, yes, I believe in it. So no, there's always the doubt because you didn't see it.
So what is the full faith?
The full faith. You have faith. Faith is something
that
has no backing. You just
what do you mean?
Yes, I
But do you have doubts? Meaning, you say that faith and doubt is two different things. Even if you can prove to me almost certainly, right? That something is one way, I can have faith the other way?
Well,
That's what you're saying. You're saying that faith and in reason.
You can say, I believe because I saw the fact.
Saying is that faith, blind faith, is part of the nature of faith. Now, it's having faith. In other words, what you are saying is that faith, blind faith, is part of the nature of faith. Now, it's having faith means something which has nothing to do with the logic, with the reasons, nothing. Right? Which means that it's acceptable for us, for someone to say that he believes in certain idol. We say, what? You believe in idol? It's ridiculous. I'll prove it to you. I'll step all over it. Nothing will happen to you, or whatever. Right? And he'll say, fine. I mean, you proved to me otherwise, but proof means nothing. I still have faith. How would we react to such a person? You would say, he's a fool. Wouldn't you say he's a fool?
True.
So, if foolishness, right, is what is the way you approach, the way your attitude towards someone who has faith not backed by reason, right? So how can we say that our attitude is that it's okay? It's okay. You go against logic. Logic has nothing to do with it. Only blind faith. We are all against blind faith in Judaism. We say blind faith is for fools, right? Our faith is faith with eyes open. That's the way our attitude is. We just say that reason can't take you all the way. Reason can only take you part way. Exactly. That after reason is exhausted, then there is a decision that goes beyond reason, and that decision we call emunah. Okay? But if the first step is not based on reasons, then your faith is based on nothing. It's an edifice on air, right? It's not blind faith at all. So now, let me go on. Yeah?
You only want to trust, not faith.
I don't want to go into it, but it's a combination. There is sometimes that emunah means trust, but let me go on one step further. Now, I always use the following analogy. A doctor who has to make a surgery, right? And he's thinking to himself, should I do it or shouldn't I do it? And he starts weighing the facts. One fact is that the man needs an operation, and if he gets the operation, there is a good chance that he'll come out healthy. On the other hand, every operation is a danger, right? So on the other hand, he may live longer if I don't make the operation, right? So he's thinking one way and another way, right? At the end, he comes out with a decision of, yes, I will make the operation. Because all in all, there is more of a chance of being successful than not being successful. Therefore, I'll make my decision on that 60-40 chance, right? There's still a chance that he may die on the operating table. But all in all, the other side is stronger than this side, right? So if so, what kind of a decision is it? A 60-40 decision. What about once the doctor decides, the surgeon decides to do the operation, to do the surgery? The acts, the act that he does, the actual operation, does it reflect the doubt or doesn't it reflect the doubt? It doesn't in any way, just the opposite. Can you imagine if the doctor's surgery would be like a 60% surgery because his decision was 60%? I mean, it wouldn't be too successful, would it? So it has to be 100% commitment to a 60% decision. We call that emunah. This is what emunah is all about. You act upon one side of that decision as if it would be a 100% decision. You can't make a 60% surgery on a 60% decision. You have to make a 100% commitment to the surgery on a 60% decision. Do you hear? So all the doubts that you have as an intelligent person are acceptable in Judaism. And that has nothing to do with your faith. Your faith is the commitment that this side of the scale is right, and I commit my life to the 60% and not to the 40%. Do you hear what emunah is? So emunah is not the thought that crosses your mind, because in the thoughts that cross your mind, you may have all kinds of doubts. There is room for uncertainty. But in your commitment, in your life, Your acts must reflect only one side, not the uncertainty. Do you hear the point? So if so, we redefine the word emunah. Emunah is the commitment to one side of the doubt. Okay? So the only way to really tell emunah is how? By looking into the person's thought process? By looking at the actions. That's the only way that emunah has a value. Right? When did Avraham Avinu show emunah? When he did it, not when he thought, because in the thoughts you had all kinds of thoughts. By its very nature, every intelligent person must have contradictory thoughts in his mind. Right? But the actions are all one-sided, to either one side or the other side. Therefore, Noah, did he have doubts? Like every intelligent person, he has doubts. What's wrong? But what would make him a completely faithful person? A person with emunah? The act. And what would have been the act which shows the commitment to that side? He's going into the ark before it starts raining. That would be the act which would show the emunah. What happened to him? He waited till it started raining. Why? Because that's the nature of Noah. Noah is a person who reacts. He doesn't act. You remember the difference between Abraham and Noah? Walking with God or walking alone in front of God? Abraham walks alone in front of God. And we said, what does that mean? He takes the initiative. He acts. Noah is a great tzaddik, but he reacts. Therefore, what Noah does is 100% consistent with its nature. He does not act, he reacts. And reacting is a lack of emunah. Because emunah means showing with your actions what you think is the right side of your belief. Okay? Yeah. Okay, let's go on. Yeah, any questions on that? Yeah. No, the truth is that it's only a reaction. You see, that's an incredible thing. How can it be working on the ark for 120 years and we don't consider it an action but a reaction? You know what would be an action on the side of Noah? If for those 120 years he would travel throughout the world, right, preaching that people should change because the world is coming to an end, right? You know what he did? He stayed in his corner building the ark, and when anybody came and asked him, why are you building the ark? He said, well, just because the world is coming to an end. He only did it as an answer to their questions.
Second question.
Yeah?
When a person accepts the Torah and knowing that the 613 commitments, and he says, certain limits for my kids, Not that they're not available, but I can't do this one. I can't stay
away from
Russia. Is that person
lacking in the law? Depends. If he says, I don't accept certain mitzvot, I accept 612 mitzvot. 613 I can't. Such a person has rejected the whole of the Torah. You can't accept part of the Torah because the essence of the Torah is acceptance. The moment you choose which mitzvahs you want to accept and which mitzvahs you don't want to accept, you have made yourself your own God. You're not accepting the Torah from God. You have created your own Torah if you choose 612 commandments. But what about if a person says, I accept all the 613 commandments, I'm just too weak to fulfill them? It's a weakness, but as far as his emunah is 100% a good person, right? And the Gemara calls him a mumar, which means someone who rebels against the Torah, but leteyavon, for the fulfillment of his own desire. He is still a person who has accepted the Torah. But the moment, you can be someone who doesn't keep a lot of laws in the Torah, but as long as you accept them, and you just say, I'm too weak to fulfill them, then you are already in a higher level. You are in a higher level than the person who keeps 612 commandments and says the 613th commandment is wrong. Right? Because there is no acceptance there. Right? Okay, now, let's go on. In Yeah.
Why when he goes into the ark does he go in this? Do they go in this order? And I think when they come out of the ark, they come out in a different order.
You're right. But the mishpochotehem. We did mention it. The idea of mishpoch. If you pay attention. When they come out of the ark here in chapter 8, it says here, verse number 19, when it summarizes everybody who went out of the ark, it says, Lemishpechoteihem yatzu. They went out to their families, meaning in groups, they went out in groups. So why is it that when they went into the ark, this word is not used? Right? So we mentioned that there is a drastic change that happens in the ark. You see, man before the flood is basically independent. Right? Like Adam. Adam was created as one person. Man is independent. The descendant of Adam is independent. We consider Noah and his family, he's surviving from the flood. It's like a new birth. Like a new birth. They come out into the world once again. In what shape? As a group. Men can't survive alone anymore. Men can only survive as a group. We become totally dependent on each other. This is the tremendous drop which happens during Noah's period. Man becomes a socially dependent animal. Why is this this way? Because the reason why men became so corrupt before the flood was because he was so independent. He was so independent, socially independent, that he developed a disrespect for anyone else, because he doesn't need anybody else to survive. He can survive alone. So the main goal in the experience of staying in the ark for so long was to develop the sense of society, right? You live together in a small environment and you develop the sense of society. That's the idea of mishpacha, family, the small group. This is why the word mishpacha, family, is used for the first time when Noah and his family come out of the ark, which means there is a drastic change in the whole attitude of men once he leaves the ark. Okay, we'll stop here. Any other questions?